from SDPB Radio. I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. While the architectural expansion and renovation continues at the National Music Museum in Vermilion, NMM Live welcomes award-winning cello virtuoso Cameron Crosman to Farber Hall in Old Main on the campus of the University of South Dakota. Crosman has performed all over the world in several different settings. He's been named Canada's next big cello star by CBC Music and the 2019-20 Classical Revelation Artist of Radio Canada. SDPB welcomed him into our Vermilion studio on the USD campus for Moment in Sound with In the Moment host Lori Walsh.
Cameron, thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you for having me.
We've got you crammed into a pretty tiny space with your cello there, but you are hopefully going to play for us here in a moment. But first, if you could preview tonight's program and to tell people a little bit about what they can hear when they stop by.
Yeah, so tonight's program is really, in a way, a celebration of music for solo cello, which spans the last 300 years, really. So I go from music written at the end of the 1600s, all the way to a piece by Ludovico Einaudi, who's a composer, a living Italian composer today. And in the middle, I visit some of the sort of monumental works for solo cello, suites by J.S. Bach and also by an English composer named Benjamin Britten.
And you have played in all kinds of different venues. Tell us a little bit about why that's important, because this is maybe not an unusual venue to you, but it's not where National Music Museum concerts would normally be performed. Talk about some of the more interesting places that you've played, whether it's a revelation for you acoustically or a real challenge.
Well, definitely. I think that, you know, all artists really are so, I think that space is so important to us, but particularly for musicians, the sound is shaped by the space we're in. And at the same time, the energy of the audience is also often shaped by the space we're in. So I've been very fortunate. I've gotten to play on some of the world-class stages in the world. I remember doing a short recital at the Philharmonie de Paris, which is their big, 2,000-seat concert hall. They had me do a little pre-recital before the orchestra concert, which is crazy, right? You're playing in this enormous theater. And then at the same time, I've played in, I've been really enjoying recently going into more unusual venues in Canada, whether that's like a brewery up in Newfoundland or some wineries. And that's really fun too, because you pack out this brewery and you're playing classical music and everyone's so excited to be there. So there's the two sides of that, and I think both of them are fantastic and great experiences.
In a digital world, we have seen, sort of experiments of, classical musicians, really amazingly talented musicians, just playing in the subway and being ignored. Or Yo-Yo Ma sort of playing as part of a cultural expression in a certain moment, a political expression, for example. How do you sort of see that then? You mentioned not only the sound, but the people around you. What if the people around you are not paying attention in some of those circumstances that I just mentioned? Or can it mean more when the people around you embrace it in a certain way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always the challenge with music in particular, because unlike when you go look at a painting in a gallery and you can choose how long you pay attention to it, with music, once you're at the concert, it's happening, right? You're there. And ultimately, I think that as a musician, you have to come to the realization that it doesn't actually matter in a way how much someone's paying attention. What matters is that it touches them somehow, however small that might be. So even if someone's walking by, I know the famous story, Joshua Bell playing in the subway in New York.
Right,
and
yeah.
Even if someone's walking by and isn't paying attention, maybe just for a moment, it made them think about something, or it cleared their mind, or it made them feel something. I think that ultimately is the goal.
Sort of like gravity works on you whether you believe it or not.
Exactly, exactly.
Maybe that music does something to you whether or not you stopped and took in the full moment. Oh, that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, some of this music, 300 years going back, and wondering what kind of venues solo cellists would have been playing at a couple hundred years ago. What do you know?
Well, I know that it's actually a fascinating, it's something I've been fascinated by, because having lived in Europe, you get to see, you actually get to play in some of these places, whether they're, you know, 14th century churches or princely palaces or things like this. The music sort of, over in Europe, is very well defined. And in North America, it's fascinating to see how, I think anyways, to see how music first came here. And I know in Canada, for instance, the first classical music performances in the early 20th century happened at the railway hotels.
Really?
Yeah. And so this has been, again, it's this whole fascinating thing where, you know, I think ultimately the music needs to happen in a place where it can bring people together.
Yeah. All right. Well, now music is happening on South Dakota Public Radio. So it's bringing people together from across the state. You haven't been here before, have you?
This is my first time in South Dakota.
So welcome. And it's many people's first time unless they've heard your recordings of listening to you. What will you play for us first?
So I'm going to start with one of the real quintessential pieces of music for solo cello. This is the prelude from Bach's First Suite.
If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Moment in Sound with cellist Cameron Crosman. You can see him tonight for National Music Museum live performance. That's at 7 p.m. on the campus of the University of South Dakota in Farber Hall. So beautiful. And
thank you.
An iconic piece, but I'm sitting here in the Sioux Falls studio listening and looking out, a little bit of snow flurrying against the autumn leaves, and a really great audio and visual picture. So thinking of all the people across the state right now who are listening to that, looking at their own sort of weather patterns.
Yes, exactly.
As that happens, it takes you to a different place. Yeah. Tell me about your recording, the French music recording that you have recently done.
Yeah, so this was sort of, one of the challenges for any artist, I think, is, you know, especially a classical artist, because we don't write our own music for the most part. We have to play pieces that other people wrote. The challenge is always, what do you record for a first album?
Right.
And for me, I feel like I was lucky because I, having studied in France, but also not being French, it sort of became very evident to me that I had to make a CD of French music. And I know my friends in France were always very jealous. They said, you know, you can do this because you're Canadian, but we could never do that because it's the cliche.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because of course, you know, it's too easy for the French people to do recordings of French music. But it was, for me, it was okay. And so it was a real sort of testament to what I love about French music and my time in Paris. Almost all of the music on that recording I had worked with cellists over there. So very personal in that sense.
Yes, and you are with Philip.
Philip Chu.
Yes. Thank you. I just lost his last name. Philip Chu.
And he's a phenomenal collaborative pianist in Canada. One of our best.
That's remarkable. Tell us a little bit about now you can consider a recording. You are playing at a certain level that is receiving accolades and awards, recognition, invitation. And yet, you've also played with and collaborated with and played for some other, masterful cellists. Mm-hmm. You have a strong sense of history, and I'm wondering how you feel about your place in history, or contemporary cellists, more broadly, a contemporary cellist today who's playing at your level. What's the role of sort of these, we know these people, we know Pablo Casals, we know Yana Starker, we know Jacqueline Dupre, or, whoever.
For sure.
What's next
really
in that
question.
Dialogue? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, that is the question. I think that is the challenge of any sort of young musician like myself living in this age is you always run into this question of, what do I have new to say?
Right.
And I think the reality is it's actually because we're all different people, there's always, as long as you're being honest with yourself, there's always something new to share through the music. And otherwise, I think that, I think with the new era comes, Pablo Casals is such a great example because he was someone who music was really a vehicle for peace for him. Mm-hmm. And I remember there's some quote from him that really stuck with me that is about how he said, what truly defines a talent is not that you have it, but how you use it. Mm-hmm. And he really felt strongly about that. And now I look at someone like Yo-Yo Ma and everything he's doing here in the U.S., but also internationally. I think that's a very noble goal anyways. And it's something I definitely always have in my mind that music does have the ability to bring people together. And it's sort of our duty to use it for that.
Yeah. How has that found its expression in you? Are there areas that you care about deeply that you try to bring awareness to? Is it about listening to people as you go places? How do you sort of grapple with that?
I think it is that what you were saying. For me, it's an amazing way to meet new people and visit new places. And it allows me to see the world. And I hope that then informs that's something that I can then, down the road share with future generations. But, even just being here, it's crazy. I was driving up from Omaha this morning and this has been in the back of my mind to come to Vermilion for like years now. And to actually be here is incredible. And that could happen thanks to what I do seems really, magical, actually.
Right. And you have so much ahead of you, too, how do you sort of define your next chapter?
That's a great question. It's something I've been thinking about a lot. Yeah. I spent the entire last year, so I actually moved back from Paris about a year ago, and I spent all of last year more or less living on the road, which was great. But now I've decided I'm settling in Montreal, back in Canada. And so for me, the next chapter is a lot more sort of also figuring out now how do I reintegrate into the culture of a city like that and of my country, and also continue to explore the world and see what kinds of projects I can create that might be interesting for people to hear.
Yeah. Tell me about your cello, and then let's talk about how you travel with it. So tell me about what you play now.
So right now, I'm very lucky. I have a cello on loan from the Canada Council for the Arts Musical Instrument Bank. This is a cello made in Spain, actually, in Barcelona, around 1769. So it's about 250 years old. And it's made by this maker named Joan Giammi. Very mysterious. We often think of old instruments as being Italian, Stradivarius, right. Del Gesu, Amati. But turns out there was a very, very fine school of Spanish instrument making in the sort of second half of the 18th century.
How did you know it was one that you wanted to choose to play?
That's one of those questions almost impossible to answer. The bank has multiple. I had a choice from the bank. There's sort of every 3 years they hold this competition open to young Canadian violinists and cellists. And so they have about five cellos. And so you do the competition, you get a sort of picking order, and you get to play the cellos and choose which one you want. And
that sounds so nerve-wracking.
Oh, it is. Well, and this was actually my second loan. Before this, I played on sort of the crown jewel of the collection, which was a Stradivarius cello.
Yeah.
From 1696, the Bonjour Stradivarius. So I couldn't have that instrument again. So I had to sort of look at the others. And it really was a matter of that this cello had a voice that spoke to me.
Yeah.
Which is challenging coming from a Strat, especially.
And then how do you travel with it and protect it and figure out how to do, you know, to do what's right by its history as well.
Exactly. Well, traveling with a cello is always an adventure, especially on planes, because we always, even in the contract for this loan, we have to buy an extra seat for the
right.
cello. So yeah. It always gets to travel in the window seat. So it's been very long since I've gotten a good view out of a plane. And it's funny, actually, with a couple other cellist friends of mine, we were joking. Every now and then, of course, we get to take a vacation, and maybe you get to go on a plane without a cello. And we're always joking. We're saying, I don't know how this is difficult for anyone. It seems so easy.
Right.
But it's just because we're used to this, you know, sort of nightmare headache challenge.
Exactly. All the looks people are giving you in, yeah.
Well, it would be one thing, you know, if you could just go on. Generally, you know, if you're just buying a flight ticket for yourself, you just go on the website and you buy a ticket and it's all good. But because the cello is not a person, you can't always do that. So
right.
often it means many hours spent on hold on the phone trying to make sure they put it in their system correctly and all these things.
Well, this is a moment in sound, so I'm hoping you'll play for us again. What will you play next, please?
Yes. So I'm going to play one of the earliest pieces ever written for cello. This is a Ricercare, which is sort of a very free improvisatory piece by an Italian composer named Domenico Gabrielli. And I think it's interesting. You can really hear how he was just discovering this instrument that was the cello and trying a whole bunch of things on it. Enjoy.
Fabulous. Cello music on Moment in Sound today from the great Cameron Crossman. He's a Canadian artist, renowned, and he's playing tonight at the University of South Dakota for National Music Museum's live performance. That's at 7 p.m. tonight. You can check that performance out. How did you, you know, we talked a little bit about some of these things that are, this is high pressure. and I'm wondering, you know, from being a kid and you know, auditions and competitions, and then getting into conservatory and you know, all the different times that pressure is on you. Talk a little bit, if you will, about learning to handle that as a young person. You know, even how old are you when you start playing?
So I was 7 when I started, and I'm 24 now.
Okay, so some of those early experiences with handling pressure and nerves, and then I want to pivot a little bit into just the rigors of the life that you've chosen and that you've chosen, and how do you find joy in that? So start with just this notion of, you know, being a little kid, really, and figuring out, like, you know, I've got something here that that I could take to a place if I can learn how to handle and how to survive it as well.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is when you're a little kid, in a strange way, because you haven't sort of developed that sort of fear of what other people think yet, it seems.
Nice.
I remember when you're very young, you just go play. It's just something you do. And then it's as you get older, actually, that you start to worry more and more about, oh, well, what do people think about this? What do people think about that?
Yeah.
And at the conservatory in Paris in particular, it was always a very high pressure situation. You know, they do things that you could never get away with in North America, where after exams, they would just announce the results in public. You know, you do your end of year playing exam, and they just announce in the middle of the school, they'd say, okay, so-and-so got this mark, so-and-so got that mark. And then they'd print it all on a sheet of paper and post it on the wall. So anyone in the school could tell how everyone else did. And, you know, not just in playing exams, in history and analysis and all these things.
Oh, wow.
Too.
The shame, the potential shame.
Exactly. And I think that you're either the type of person that really doesn't work in that type of environment, or it sort of really pushes you. And for me, I was lucky that it worked out. Like, I was able to work through it and get to the other side. But yeah, there's always pressure. You always sort of need to, especially now in the digital age, you never know what's going to be broadcast, how long it's going to stay around. And you always need to sort of have in the back of your mind that awareness that, you know, you always need to be on, which you should be anyways. But I think now particularly it's even more so.
But I'm also wondering if I've noticed in a younger generation a willingness to be imperfect and silly and unattractive, and you're so used to being on that you're like, well, you know, I can't be on all the time, so I'm just going to be me. And that's kind of embraced, and clearly not from a performance standpoint, but from a life, you know, you're human just like the rest of
us. Well, I think exactly. And I think we're definitely coming around to that. In music, it's been difficult because of recording technology. You know, you can make a recording and it's perfect. And a live performance is never going to quite be like a recording.
Right.
There are some people out there that are phenomenal and they can do that, but we're not all sort of cut from that cloth. And that is something that is more coming, something I had to come to terms with in a way that I can always try to do my best. But the reality is, you know, I'm not always necessarily going to give a performance that is 100% what I want. And that's a good thing, because otherwise,
like,
what would
better.
I work on?
Yeah, yeah. I like that as an audience member. I like that better, because I feel like I was there for a real thing, a real moment.
Exactly.
Anyone can listen to a recording.
Exactly. And I think there's something interesting about the live performance where, although, yes, things can go wrong, there can also be sort of the heights of energy of a live performance, which can never be replicated.
Right. And then if you record it, you're like, no, you watch it later and you're like, you had to be there. There was an energy in the room that was palpable.
Yeah.
Play one more for us, please. One more piece.
Okay, one last piece. This is a little bit to do with my cello. This is a piece by a Spanish cellist and composer, a student of Casals named Gaspar Casado, and this is the prelude from his suite for solo cello. Thank you.
SDPB Sports and Recreation reporter Nate Weck stopped by the studio to recap the state high school golf tournament with host Lori Walsh.
SDPB's Nate Weck is with us here for your weekly sports and rec update. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Yeah, that's that always seems to happen.
Yes, so tell me what season we're actually in right now.
Yeah, fall maybe? I mean, did we skip fall? And are we going right to winter? I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, just to kind of get everybody up to speed, the fall championship season for high school sports got underway here this week. Monday, Tuesday was pretty busy. Yankton and Vermilion were hosting boys' state golf tournaments, and Sioux Falls was hosting the Class A girls' tennis tournament, which this is the first year, 2019 is the first, the fall of 2019 is the first year that tennis for both boys and girls has moved to a two-class system. Monday, Tuesday, we had Class A tennis in Sioux Falls, and then tomorrow and Friday is the Class AA girls tennis tournament, and so we'll see what Mother Nature does with that, but there are some indoor locations in the Sioux Falls area that will more than accommodate those if weather makes it where they have to move indoors. But as far as the golf side goes, just to give a super quick recap, and then we got to get into kind of a fun little story that arose at one of the tournaments. But Sioux Falls Roosevelt and Sioux Falls Christian won team titles, Roosevelt with the AA, and Sioux Falls Christian with A. Mitchell won the girls' tennis championship. It's also the sixth time since 1973 that a non-Rapid City or non-Sioux Falls school has won a girls' tennis title. Huh. But now that they're going to a dual class, I think that you'll see that a lot more just because Class A, there's really not a lot of Rapid City and Sioux Falls ties there. On the individual side for Class AA golf, Jack Lundin of Sioux Falls Roosevelt got the individual title. And then on the A side, which is what we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about, Lance Christensen Jr. of Little Wound won by 5 strokes on Tuesday. He led after the first day, and he continued that on and is just the second Native American in South Dakota high school history to win a individual golf title.
Wow.
Yeah, let that sink in. Yeah. Pretty cool stuff.
Tell me about Lance.
So Lance is from Little Wound. He lives in Kyle, South Dakota, which is on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And so, yeah, we talked to him after the first day, and then Brian Gevick also spoke with him after they got done yesterday, too, and after he did win the state championship. And, you know, one of the things was that we asked Lance was, how are you able to stay on top in day two when you were already getting that attention and such after day one? And here's what Lance had to say.
Well, I just tried to hit it in the fairway. I probably could have played a lot better today, but I just had to D up and just do what I had to do to get the win. And I'm used to the wind. Where we're from, we call it prairie golf. So we love the win. We just keep playing.
Prairie golf. Yeah.
Kind of funny, right? Funny kid.
It's windy. Who cares? Yeah. I've done this before.
And it was really windy yesterday. I felt bad for some of the golfers. And I think a lot of them, you know, luckily it was windy at both locations and stuff like that. It was windy throughout the day so that there was really every golfer experienced the same kind of conditions.
Yeah.
We did talk that Lance is just the second Native kid in South Dakota to win a state golf championship. The first was Corey Jensen of Todd County. He was on the Rosebud Reservation and won a state golf championship in 1998. So for the Pine Ridge Reservation, Lance Christensen Jr. is the first. So that's pretty cool. And I'm sure when he gets home, whether it was last night or today, he is going to have quite the celebration and a lot of people that are going to want to be talking to him. And he's going to be getting a lot of attention these next few days because of it. Another interesting part is because Lance and his family did grow up on the Pine Ridge Reservation, he's not very close to any golf courses. And he does have like a driving range type of setup at his house because his dad was a high school golfer as well, and golf has always kind of been a part of their family. But practicing and things like that, if you want to practice putting, you have to go a different direction. So he actually has to travel 45 miles to play on a real golf course in Gordon, Nebraska. Imagine the dedication and things like that that go along with it. So we talked to Lance's father, who is also Lance Christensen, and spoke about how his family almost left the Pine Ridge Reservation when Lance was in elementary school.
When Lance Christensen Jr. was probably about a fourth or fifth grade, I don't remember what year, I remember talking with his mother, Lana, about moving him away from the reservation, moving away from Kyle, just so that he could be around a golf course more regularly because he loved it so much. And he told me, Dad, I can do it from here. I can do it from here. Don't worry about it.
And he did it from there.
And he did it from there.
Yeah.
Oh, I like this guy.
And he's a junior.
Really?
Obviously, the next question is, so what's next for you? What's your next goal? And I'll let Lance tell you what he said.
I'm excited. Just going to get back to work. I'm not done yet. And you're wrong if you think I am.
You're wrong if you think I am. Talk about a determined kid. And
This is an athlete who knows who he is, knows why he's doing what he's doing. Right. He has a clarity of focus.
Right.
A clarity of awareness. Humble.
Right.
Yeah.
His dad also, because his dad's an assistant coach for the team, and his dad was talking to him when he was on the driving range a little bit. And, Lance Jr. walks off the driving range after warm-ups yesterday morning and goes, I'm going to go win it today.
Really?
And just had that determination. And things did get evened up first few holes. And then you just kind of saw it as the day progressed. You're like, ooh, Lance is back in front by a couple strokes. Ooh, now he's up by 3. And then you get to, the last few holes and it's like, holy smokes, I think he's going to do it. And sure enough, he did. And what a cool thing. I mean, he got a lot of attention and I think he deserves a lot of it because he showed some real guts to already have microphones in your face after day one,
right,
knowing you have to go back out and actually finish this thing.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of high school kids that will break down in an instance like that because the pressure is just too great. And this kid looked pressure right in the face and said, I'm going to go get it. Yeah. And he did.
I'm glad he did. All right. So one of the things when we always have these conversations and you talk to these athletes and the coaches and the parents is, you know, there's some similarities when you say, you know, how did you coach? Oh, I'm just putting it down the fairway and I'm just doing, you know. But I guess maybe I'm just realizing for the first time that that's how you get to the top. There's a real lesson right there, and say when you listen to those and you hear those themes, that's not a sports cliche. That's a sports lesson. And if you want to be successful, that's what your mindset really needs to be, because everyone who gets there has a very similar,
right,
you know, sort of.
And that's the thing too, is, you know, you'd think with golf, you just go out and you hit the ball, but there's so much more to it. Like, you know, in that first bite, we heard him talking about even the strategy of it, about, I need to D up. I need to play defensive golf today.
Yeah. I was going to ask you what that means. Yep, D up. And so in the context of golf, what is defensive golf?
Basically understanding what your stroke lead is. Maybe instead of being more aggressive, okay, you're a little bit more conservative. So rather than, man, if I cut this right, I might be able to get it up to the green, or do I just play it safe and set up another shot that will put me equally as close? Do I just play it safe here?
Yeah.
And I think that's, in my eyes, that's what defensive, when he says D up, that's what that means, is playing defensively, understanding the situation, understanding the lead that you have, and not going out and trying to increase that lead or, you know, mm-hmm, getting even more strokes, but just going out and trying to protect that lead.
Right.
So that's what he was doing.
Fascinating. What a great story. Will we see this stuff online?
Yes, there's already one video up on our SDPB Sports Facebook page of this kid, as well as a small little snippet too from the AA winner, Jacqueline Dean of Roosevelt. And then we're also going to have another piece up so you can hear a little bit more from Lance Christensen Jr. and his father about his historic win.
All right. So follow SDPB Sports on Facebook and Twitter. Nate Weck, thanks so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
The Lakota Music Project heads to Washington, D.C. for an unprecedented cultural initiative. An ensemble comprised of 9 core South Dakota Symphony Orchestra musicians, along with Native American musicians Brian Akipa and Emmanuel Blackbear, Native American actor Barry Laveau, Lakota elder Chris Eaglehawk, Black Hill State University Professor Emeritus Ronnie Ties, and Maestro Delta David Geyer will travel to Washington after a South Dakota send-off concert Tuesday, October 15th at 7:30 p.m. inside the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. Delta David Geyer and SDSO Executive Director Jennifer Tysinger share details with Lori.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Here's a list of who's going. So you've got the ensemble of 9 musicians, so the strings and the woodwinds, right?
Mm-hmm.
There we go. And then Native American musicians Brian Akipa, Emmanuel Blackbear, Native American actor and activist Barry Laveau, Lakota elder Chris Eaglehawk, Black Hill State University Professor Emeritus Ronnie Tice, and the maestro and Jennifer all heading out to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Did I forget anybody?
Oh, well, we have a couple extra staff members going as well.
Right. This is a big deal and a long time coming.
Indeed.
Tell me, Delta David Geyer, about the residency first, to sort of put into context. This is a national event.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, Joseph Horowitz, who's probably our leading American musicologist, many, many books, very well respected. He's been here several times. We've created programs with him. But when he experienced the Lakota Music Project, he saw how innovative it was and the uniqueness of it. And he said, I'm going to look for an opportunity to bring you to D.C. too, because this needs national attention. And sure enough, you know, we've already had what, 2 articles in the Washington Post, and like it's happening.
You're right. Joseph Horowitz has been on this program. You've brought mm-hmm. him in, and he's here. And he does a lot of writing, as you say, online. I can't get to the bottom of. I can read and read, and there's always more.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah,
just
yeah.
what a great mind that you know, thinking about classical music today and all its all its various functions and history and relevance today. Jennifer, tell me a little bit about your sort of first encounter with Lakota Music Project, because that's before you even came to South Dakota Symphony right. Orchestra.
Right. When I knew that I would be in conversation with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra about coming here as the executive director, I was reading about the Lakota Music Project, and I recalled, ah, yes, this is the orchestra that does the Lakota Music Project. That's what I knew about the South Dakota Symphony from, you know, 20 years of orchestral management experience. This is what I couldn't quite remember where Lakota Music Project was, except that it was the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra that did it. And when I realized I would have the opportunity to be part of this organization that is doing this kind of work, it all of a sudden made the job even that much more exciting,
right?
Because other orchestras aren't doing this. This is a completely new opportunity to be part of something like this.
There was a send-off concert Tuesday, October 15th at 7:30 p.m. in the Washington Pavilion, and then you hit the road through the 16th through the 21st, you're in residency. Tell me, Delta David Geyer, some of the highlights, because there was a lot happening that when you're out. You have to be, I mean, I know you've been planning this and been part of this for so long, but I have to think that when you're in some of these places, you'll be humbled by, I mean, it's humbling to think of this group of musicians playing in some of these venues and bringing this project to the country and the world.
Indeed, yeah. So the main program for us is on Saturday the 19th, and it's a performance at the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian on the mall in Washington. And what the museum really wants is the history of the Lakota Music Project. How did you put it together? And honestly, one of the biggest challenges for that program is to make sure that us white folks aren't talking too much, because the museum's all about giving Native Americans a voice. So this will be a lot about Chris Eaglehawk, elder from Pine Ridge, Brian Akipa, cedar flute player from Sisseton, Emmanuel Black Bear, keeper of the drum for the Creekside Singers from Pine Ridge, and, you know, giving them the voice of what the Lakota Music Project has meant to them. And, you know,
isn't going to be hard for you, because that's what you've been doing this whole time.
That's right.
Is stepping aside and handing the space to, collaboratively, of course.
Well, yeah, also, you have to steer the ship, but you're right. It really is all about our collaboration. And then on Monday evening at the national, we have a program at the National Cathedral, and this is part of Joseph Horowitz's series. And our string quartet will be giving the world premiere of a very important quartet written a century ago by a composer named Arthur Farwell, who is categorized as an Indianist, which is, and this is deliberately provocative in the sense of, well, first of all, Joe really believes in the music, and that's, so that's the main reason for doing it. And our quartet will be featured on a Naxos recording, a CD, the world premiere of this piece. But it's also at this particular cultural moment that we're in at now, the whole idea of Indianist smacks of cultural appropriation and those kinds of questions. And there'll be forums for public discussion around each of these programs. So, and Joe welcomes that, you know, welcomes the controversy. You know, and we've done that here. With Joe, actually, with, you know, is there a difference between cultural appropriation and cultural misappropriation and commercialization, commodification of things versus the artistic representation and paying respect to other cultures, and which has always been part of classical music for hundreds of years. So these are discussions that will be had publicly there, and hopefully it won't come out with too much egg on my face.
That's one of the things I find interesting about this, and I'm wondering if you have more experience in those other spaces than I do, but I know every time, you know, if I have even friends who are not from South Dakota, or my daughter in college in New York City, the great gap of knowledge that there is even a living Lakota culture in other places can be astonishing when you leave the state, and the things that people will say. Not that people don't say things here in South Dakota, but when you go, you know, do you anticipate that there are going to be people in this venue who have never seen or considered that Lakota people exist outside of history books?
I don't anticipate that because of the spaces we're playing in, and because, you know, you go to the Museum of the American Indian, you know. I'm guessing that most of the people who are going to be coming to these performances will be people that are engaged, although there will be a certain percentage of people at the Saturday performance at the museum that are just there to be at the museum, right? They're just coming, and so they'll happen upon us at that moment. So... but it, you know, it's not just Lakota. I mean, it's American Indians, period.
Right.
You know, and the history behind it, and that's. I mean, you're right. People on the coasts don't think a whole lot about Native Americans, and like the Lenape in New Jersey, they've been gone for a long time. You know, so. My kids, when they were in school in New Jersey, they learned about Lenape history. You know, heck, I learned about Iroquois history living in Western New York in the 70s, you know, but never met an Iroquois person, you know. So, yeah, you're right about that. It's a very interesting thing to bring these living artists together with an orchestra.
Jennifer, what has the, as we talk about the send-off concert, tell me a little bit about the excitement and the buzz from people in South Dakota, from supporters of the Symphony Orchestra, to say it's a big thrill. Like, the world gets to see more of what we've been watching all along.
Right, right. Well, you know, first of all, this is the first time that the South Dakota Symphony's Lakota Music Project has performed outside of South Dakota, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for that first time leaving the state to be performing in Washington, D.C. is really telling, right? It's not that the first time that we're performing is in a neighboring state, right, which you would have thought would have happened already.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we're going all the way to D.C. So that in itself is very exciting. The other thing about Tuesday night is that it's the only opportunity for people to hear this year. It's the only time that we're performing this program in Sioux Falls or in South Dakota.
Correct.
This year.
Yeah.
So unless you come to Washington, D.C. with us, which we would love,
yeah, come on.
your opportunity to hear the Lakota Music Project in this form is Tuesday night at 7:30. So this is in the Washington Pavilion, but it's in the Visual Art Gallery.
Oh.
So in a more intimate space, and it's free. We want everyone to come.
Let's finish out this week's arts podcast with poetry from Studio 47 with Patrick Hicks.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Jean Dubrow. Dubrow was born on November 11th, 1975, in Vicenza, Italy. She was the daughter of U.S. diplomats and grew up in the far-flung places that her parents worked, including the former Yugoslavia, Zaire, Poland, Belgium, and Austria. She received her undergraduate degree from St. John's College in Annapolis before getting her MFA from the University of Maryland. After this, she went to the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, where she received her PhD. Her books include From the Fever World, Stateside, Red Army Red, The Arranged Marriage, Dots and Dashes, and Through Smoke. Her latest book is Simple Machines, which won the Richard Wilbert Poetry Award. Among the many prizes she has won over the course of her writing are the Crab Orchard Series, the Diode Editions Book Contest Prize, and the Towson University Prize for Literature. She is a professor of creative writing at the University of North Texas. Today's poem is Chernobyl Year. That name, Chernobyl, conjures up images of men in radioactive suits, of huge billowing clouds of atomic poison, and of abandoned apartment blocks. On April 26, 1986, a massive explosion happened in the number 4 reactor of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Immediately, a fireball punched into the night sky, and for 9 terrifying days, a dark radioactive cloud spewed up from the open pit of the reactor. The meltdown was ferocious, and it seemed unstoppable. Huge parts of the Soviet Union were contaminated, along with areas of Western Europe. Children in Germany and Scandinavia were told to stay indoors. The eruption of smoke was finally contained on May 4, 1986, but by then, levels of radioactivity were beyond anything the world had ever seen at any time before. Some 49,000 people were evacuated from the nearby town of Pripyat, and high rates of cancer soon struck the area. An unknown number of deaths have resulted from the disaster, and the area surrounding the ruined nuclear reactor won't even be moderately safe for life until the year 2065. Chernobyl remains the worst nuclear disaster in history, and long may it stay that way. Dubrow spent part of her adolescence in Warsaw, which in terms of geographic proximity isn't too far from this moment in history. In fact, she lived in Warsaw from 1980 to 1983, and also from 1987 to 1991. While she wasn't there when Chernobyl exploded in 1986, it was something that clearly influenced her understanding of the world. When I asked her about this, she said, "For me, the poem is really a metaphor for adolescence, the radioactivity of moving toward adolescence." This is Chernobyl Year by Jean Dubrow. We dreamed of glowing children, their throats alive and cancerous, their eyes like lightning in the dark. We were uneasy in our skins, sixth grade, a year for blowing up, for learning that nothing contains the heat which comes from growing, the way our parents seemed at once both tall as cooling towers and crushed beneath the pressure of small things, family dinners, the evening news, the dead voice of the dial tone. Even the ground was ticking. The parts that grew, grew poison. Whatever we ate became a stone. Whatever we said was love became plutonium, became a spark of panic in the buried world.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. In the Moment airs live on SDPB Radio Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain. Listen live online or find individual segments at listen.sdpb.org. If you want every In the Moment conversation delivered daily to your mobile device, subscribe to the In the Moment Segments podcast. You can also connect with us on social media. Follow us on Twitter, @MomentSDPB, and on Instagram, SDPB In the Moment. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Josh, Lori Walsh, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Chris Loffrey. Thanks for listening.